Welcome to the Cello Sherpa Podcast, where we explore all aspects of the climb to the summit, from intermediate musician to the professional stage. Check us out online at thecellosherpa.com or follow us on Twitter and Instagram at thecellosherpa. I'm Joel Dallow, your host. I joined the cello section of the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra in 1999 and founded the Riverside Chamber Players based in Roswell, Georgia in 2003. As you start to think about heading back to school, many schools and youth symphonies will be holding seating auditions. So if you're looking for coaching on your orchestral excerpts or solo repertoire to prepare for this, head on over to www.thecellosherpa.com and drop us a line. We offer virtual or in-person lessons. Today's episode is sponsored by Clear Resources, your premier resource for compliance, legal, ethics, and risk. For more information, visit them online at clearresources.com. Today's guest is Icelandic-American cellist Sæunn Þorsteinsdóttir. She has performed all over the U.S., Europe, and Asia as a soloist with many orchestras and also as a chamber musician. She just finished her first year as assistant professor of cello at the University of Cincinnati College Conservatory of Music. Welcome back to the Cello Sherpa Podcast.
Thanks so much for having me again.
The last time you joined us as our guest was all the way back in the first season, and you were still on faculty at the University of Washington in Seattle. So things have changed quite a bit for you as you moved all the way across the country to Cincinnati, Ohio to teach at the conservatory there. How has this last year been with such a big change?
Well, yes, I can't believe it's been that long. It feels like yesterday we were just chatting, but yes, it's been a whirlwind of a year. And a lot of times I felt like I was building the plane as I was flying it, but it's been really great. Just getting a couple weeks now after school is done, that first year is done. And I look back and I can't believe it's over already. So time flies, you know?
Yeah. So talk about what has been the biggest change for you.
Well, I think the biggest change for me has just been the sort of, well, of course, it's a bigger school. The conservatory is, I think, 1,200 students, where the University of Washington was much smaller. And with that come a lot of great opportunities for the students. And it's also more competitive to get in. So the students have maybe had a longer time that they were singularly focused on their instrument and their development. So it's a little bit of a different attitude, I would say, for the students. And it's been really great to have this sort of change of pace and trying to find my feet and how I can help them the best.
Would you say that Cincinnati's a straight up conservatory versus coming from a university music program, even though the title doesn't really spell it out that way?
Yeah, I would say that. Even though the conservatory is a part of the University of Cincinnati, many people don't know that, but it's actually a part of the University of Cincinnati, which was a state school. And so it does have those other academics, and it is a great, well-rounded school. But the conservatory really is its own thing. I mean, they even call it CCM Village, this little area of the campus that has all the practice rooms, all the studios, all that stuff. And so it's really its own little thing and its own little nest for music.
Can you put your finger a little bit more on the differences between that type of environment versus coming from the university environment? Because I know we've talked about this last time about the differences in both of them, but now you have this direct experience of one versus the other. And I'm curious, has it changed the way that you're approaching your students? Are you getting a different kind of student? And have you had to adjust to that type of teaching also?
Yeah, I think it does attract a different kind of student. I think the kind of student that comes to a conservatory usually knows that this is definitely what they want to do. They've definitely put in a lot of hours with this and are sort of all in. Mm-hmm. And so it's really about, you know, they're sort of chomping at the bit, right?
Yeah.
Whereas maybe at the University of Washington, they've had a more, maybe a broader perspective, are super smart and great musicians, but just, you know, maybe are double majoring or something like that, which make them really interesting people and great students to teach, but it is a slightly different focus.
Yeah.
And so this has really clarified for me also as a teacher what I need to be focusing on and what the students that are so excited about music and excited about going into cello and really wanting to do this and are very passionate about it, what kind of guidance they need versus someone who maybe is a little bit more exploring still.
Yeah.
I think that's where the difference for me has been.
When you start out as a first-year teacher there, how does that work as far as recruiting students? How big was your studio? Did you have to do other things other than teaching the cello this year to make up for your class load difference? Or talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, definitely. So as I came in, I did not inherit a studio. So I really am starting sort of from scratch. I had a couple students, but a very small studio. And so I've been doing a lot of things like coaching chamber music, teaching pedagogy, you know, just sort of things to cover some bases while I'm building my studio. Mm-hmm. And that's been also really interesting because it's giving me also kind of a broader sense of the community, getting to know other students, getting to know other, you know, the violin studios and viola studios and bass studios, and just to get a real feel for the school, actually. It's been really fun.
Yeah. And what's your expected class load, or what's a full studio for you at Cincinnati?
So a full studio is 16 students.
Okay.
That's like a full load. Some of that, you know, they might not need, in terms of balancing the orchestra, they might not need me to teach 16 students. So I might do a little bit of chamber music along with that, but that's sort of the expected full load.
And how are you working to recruit to get up to that number of students, especially being new to an area, must have its own challenges also?
Yeah, well, what I'm noticing is that basically my recruitment is through my network with other teachers. Mm-hmm. So teachers that trust that I'm going to continue on a similar path. So maybe people that I went to school with or people that I have had the same teachers as me, you know, coming from a similar background that understand where that student has been and what they're growing towards. So that's been a big, it's basically been my network of other teachers who trust me to take care of their students' development as they go. And then everywhere I go and when I play, I try to do a masterclass. I try to find ways to interact with young cellists just to get a feel for if somebody really is interested and if CCM might be something that would be a good fit for them. Uh-huh. So it's kind of a balance. It's sort of, I have my network of people that I trust, and certainly my former teachers are a big part of that, and people that I went to school with and people that I've played with. And also I try to do some recruitment on my own as I travel and do masterclasses.
Does that involve also going to the local schools or going into the school districts at all and discovering people there? Or what part of your job is that?
I haven't done that this year. I'm planning on doing some of that next year. I think for this area, the youth orchestras are really a good recruitment tool because they do get in-state tuition and they're at a high level that if they want to go into music, that CCM would be a good fit for them.
Yeah, that makes sense. I know you have a new album out called Marrow, and I assume it's the 6 Bach cello suites, right?
That's right.
Can you talk about the title Marrow and whether this is part of the requirement of becoming a full tenured faculty member? Are these the kinds of projects that you're expected to do and how all of that plays into your career path?
Yeah. So yes, the title of the album is Marrow, but it is the 6 Bach cello suites. I'll start with the end of the question, which is this the kind of thing that you're expected to do to get tenure? Yes and no. I think there are so many ways that you can sort of quote unquote publish. They want to see you doing research, which could include commissioning, premiering new pieces, could be recording, could be writing articles, writing books. Mm-hmm. So yes and no. I mean, this was not a project that I did for my tenure file.
Okay.
This is definitely a passion project for me. Even before the pandemic, I had started to want to sort of reclaim the suites for myself. As I was teaching them, I was realizing I hadn't really gone back and played all of them in a way that I was super confident in or really was the way that I think I wanted to play them. I sort of still had remnants of, you know, learning the 2nd suite when I was much younger and had a different teacher. And I just hadn't sort of upgraded some of the suites to the level that I currently and the way that I feel about Bach these days. Mm-hmm. So I started to do a lecture series on each one, and I sort of did it over the year. This was the 1920 academic year, and I did one by one. I sort of gave myself the deadline of having each suite upgraded by then. And it was so fun going back and researching them and really going back to all the bowings, all the fingerings, just to make sure that I was really doing what I basically walking the walk, playing the way that I was preaching to my students to play.
Yeah.
Then the pandemic hit, and one of the only concerts that actually I ended up doing was that summer. I ended up playing all six box suites in Iceland, going from church to church, six churches, you know, each suite, one suite per church in the Westfjords. And it was an incredible experience. And I just thought, yeah, this was something that had been carrying me sort of through the pandemic. It's easy to play alone.
Yeah.
So the recording really was just for me wanting to honor the work that I had done in sort of getting these pieces that mean so much to me and really speak to me on such a deep level. And that's where the marrow comes in. I feel like these pieces, they live in my bones. And that's why sort of I felt like marrow. There's also another twist on it, which is sort of, I think marrow, that's where sort of our stem cells are, right? That's where our, I think of Bach and I think of all these little cells that go through the suites and how he can make something so big out of something really small. And I don't know, there was just something that really resonated with me.
I think it makes perfect sense. And the way that you described it is exactly what I was thinking when I read the title.
Yeah.
So it probably doesn't even need the description because it feeds itself. So I appreciate hearing that. I'm curious, if you go listen to Bach, and there's lots of recordings of Bach, and there's so many different approaches. So I tell my students, look, this is the way that I learned it. This is sort of my influence. But go listen to six recordings of that movement and see what resonates with you and start to feel your own sense of how you feel the music too. So would you be able to pinpoint perhaps where some of your biggest influences have come to making this album and how you approached Bach as a grown-up in this album rather than just sort of through the DNA of our teachers?
Yeah. A big influence for me was Honor Bylsma and actually working with him and his book, The Art of Fencing. Or Bach, The Fencing Master. That's right. It's,
oh, okay.
Yeah. And just the way, the passion that he has for all the little details, all of the little slight variations in bowing. And that really inspired me to go back to the facsimiles that we have. And so I got kind of nerdy. I got really researchy. I got, not that I play in a perfectly historically informed way, but I started to appreciate the simplicity of a sound that was a little more pure, also a little more theory-based, a little bit more like I really looked at the bass lines, I looked at the harmonies, and I'm really treating the melody line as improvisation on the harmonies underneath. And so for me, it's about having both the structure of the harmony and the bass line, plus the freedom of how those connect.
Yeah.
So I don't really know where that lands in terms of, I think I don't play in a romantic style, but maybe people might listen to it and think that it's a romantic, I don't know. But for me, it just comes from a place of wanting to really get into the nitty gritty of it and really try to take away the influences of all these great recordings that, of course, we have in our ears, right?
Yeah.
But sort of go back to, okay, what is Bach trying to do? Oh, he's building this from this bass line. If this were figured bass, then it probably would be this. Oh, and so this is the leading tone, or this is the way that this resolves, or actually it doesn't resolve for another two bars, or those kind of questions. And I really tried not to listen to anything else while I was doing it.
Yeah.
So it's hard for me to even put it into context because now I'm so in it. And I just, I mean, not anymore. It's actually out there. So
So you got to study with Honor Bylsma?
Yeah, I had some master classes with him at Kronberg. And then a few times I went to Amsterdam and saw him there. So it's really wonderful.
Yeah, I've always loved the way he plays Bach in particular. It's really exceptional and stands out in a sea of many Bachs.
Yeah.
And you mentioned improvisation. I know you've also been experimenting with improvisation. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah, improvisation has become a really big part of my life. And it's one of those things that I didn't know I needed. But now that I have it, it's taking over my musical life. I think it started when I was seven, when I moved to the States. I didn't speak English, but I had studied cello for 2 years. And I had a really wonderful teacher who did this thing with me that was, she calls it talking cellos. And basically, she would play a little phrase and then I would play something back.
Uh-huh.
Like we're having a conversation. And at the time, I just thought we were playing a game, right?
Yeah.
Because I didn't really understand the words that she was using to explain. So it was a lot of just mimicking. But then in this game, it wasn't just mimicking. It was me using the cello to try to say something, to communicate. And that for me, I think, I've sort of traced it back. I think that was sort of the seed of this.
Yeah.
And then since then, you know, there are just like little hints here and there where I felt like I could use the cello to communicate what I was feeling, or, and not just through other people's music, but through my own sort of doodles. And so I actually have a way that I encourage my students to start to improvise, and I call them sound doodles, which is just basically like as if you were doodling on a piece of paper, like drawing,
uh-huh.
but just with sound.
Yeah.
And so just playing whatever you feel. If you're angry, play something that sounds angry to you or feels angry to you. Or if you're sad, to play something like that. Or if you're really bored, you know, just doing something that reflects that through your instrument. As people that are constantly serving a composer, serving a conductor, serving somebody else through the music, I find it, I just need that as a counterbalance.
Yeah.
Of, okay, well, what do I really have to say? What do I really want to say? And what's my unique voice? And so I have a couple of projects that are going more in that improvisation vein. And it's been so, so freeing, not just for the improvisation, but also the pieces that I'm playing and the way that I work with composers. I feel like I can translate, quote unquote, so much better.
Yeah.
In terms of like, what does the music want to say and how can I say it?
So does that mean that if somebody were to sit you down with a jazz chart in front of you, that you could improvise the chords, or are you talking more about just freeing your own expression from within?
Yeah. I mean, I probably could figure it out if you give me some time and, you know, I was looking at the chart, I probably could figure it out. But this is more of an intuitive, on an intuitive level.
Mm-hmm.
I can give myself some, I call them enabling constraints, in the same way that if I tell you, name 100 things that are white, you'd probably come up with like 2 or 3. But if I say, name 100 things that are white in your kitchen, you'd probably come up with 50.
Yeah.
In that way, I sort of give myself these enabling constraints to help myself be more creative.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be things like a mode, a key, that can be those things. But then I also can do it on a rhythm. I can do it on 12 tone. I can do it on making only sounds without pitch. You know, if there's so many different ways to improvise. And definitely, if I think about contemporary music, chords are not necessarily the main thing that
right.
they're working with. It's going to be more like texture, or it's going to be more like contrast, or it's going to be more emotional, or, you know, it's going to be other things other than that. So, yeah, I don't like to necessarily say that I improvise in a jazz kind of idiom or a bluegrass, or like, you know, obviously those have deep traditions of improvisation. And I think I'm coming at it from a little more of an intuitive level.
Are you planning any recording projects that involve some of this?
Yes, I have some ideas, but nothing concrete yet that I can share. But I will definitely let you know once I get some funding.
Well, and that was actually, that's a good point, because I wanted to ask you that also. How many albums have you recorded?
So the Marrow is my third album.
Okay.
So I did Britten Suites. I did Vernacular, which is all Icelandic music. And then this is my third. So that's Bach.
And how do you go about funding for these projects? Because there are a lot of costs associated with producing any album. So if you're willing to share some of your secrets, I'm sure that would be helpful to people.
Yeah. Well, I think most of the time it's been self-funded. I mean, I've just really saved up and really tried to make sure that I'm working with the studio, the engineer, and the producer on what would make sense for everybody. But I did get some grants.
Mm-hmm.
There are some recording grants. I think the money part of this is so hard because you do it without any expectation of making any money on it.
Yeah.
So it really is a passion project. However, I think it's so important that we don't lose the art of recording, because it's a very different thing than performing.
Yeah.
It's a different art form. You know, there's a way that I play when I'm performing the Bach suites that is related to, but not quite the same way that I played them when I was recording them. And I didn't realize that when I did the Britten suites.
Mm-hmm.
It definitely was playing more as I performed. And in fact, I'll share, in case anyone is going through the recording process, the Britten suites, the first and the third, are all attacca, you know, so they're each about 20 minutes and it's a whole suite. And I was so arrogant that I thought, okay, I'm going to do this. I'm really going to go for it. I'm just going to do whole takes of the whole suite. So I did like 3 full takes of the first suite. And then I was like totally done. I couldn't, like, I had no energy left. I had no concentration. I had no focus. And so it was really actually hard to splice and edit, because it was actually nearly impossible. And so I learned from that. Don't do that, kids. Don't do that at home.
Okay, so then let's talk a little more about that. Can you be more specific about the difference between playing a live concert versus recording? Because personally, I'm very uncomfortable recording. I feel like it's such an unnatural thing to do that I have a hard time with it.
Yes.
It's fine when I'm in the whole orchestra, but by myself, I don't have any solo albums out there, probably the reason why.
Well, okay, so I always thought I was really bad at recording. Like when I was making audition tapes, when I was in school, I wasn't very good at it because I had the same mentality as a performance. And I get it. When you're making a live recording and you're, you know, for auditions, I understand that you have to treat it as a performance. When I was doing these recordings, and especially the Bach, instead of thinking, oh, this microphone is going to pick up every single little thing and they're going to hear all the little mistakes, those are going to be edited out. Everything that you hear, all those gritty or whatever little things, that's not going to matter. However, if you turn it around and think, wow, this microphone is going to pick up every little thing I do.
Uh-huh.
So why not amplify all of the things that I want the audience to hear, but usually they can't hear because they're further away, or we're in a bigger space, or I just simply can't focus on those tiny little details when I've got an hour-long concert of repertoire that I need to keep my focus at a certain manageable level for an hour.
Yeah.
Whereas I can do small spurts of really concentrated, wonderful takes that then the microphone can really capture. And then what you really need is a great producer who can tell you, okay, this is awesome, go more in that direction, or, oh, this isn't going to fit with the rest of how we've been doing things, so we're going into a direction that isn't going to jive, let's try something else, you know, to just steer you along. But if you have a great producer that you trust, and it doesn't have to be some famous producer, it can be a friend that you really trust or a colleague that you really respect, then they can tell you, well, now you're actually really slow. This is a lot slower than what you were playing 3 takes ago or whatever.
Yeah.
So we're not going to be able to splice that together. But I like the idea. And can you do that again, but in tempo or whatever? And so then you can really grasp all these little details and all these little special things in the music on a much deeper level.
Yeah. And what was the space you used to record the suites?
So I recorded them in the Sonoluminous Studios, which is the record label. They also have a studio in Virginia. And I recorded my Vernacular album there also. And as soon as I stepped foot in there, I thought, if I ever record Bach, I'm going to do it in here. Because they have taken a church and completely acoustically, with panels and everything, made it into this incredible acoustic. And it's just magic in there. So it was really wonderful to play in there because there was a lot of sound coming back to me.
Yeah.
So I could hear what I was doing. And they really understood where the microphones should go in that space to get the sound. And I have to say, Dan Shores, that works with them, is an incredible engineer. He's enhanced what I was doing, I almost can't believe it when I hear it because it just sounds so amazing. And I just thought, is that me? Was I doing that?
That's great.
So
well,
it
can't
helps.
Fake it. So
it really helps, though.
Did you keep track of how many recording sessions or how many hours it took to put the entire album together? Because that's a big chunk of music.
So this is another, don't do this at home. What I did, which I would never do again, is I went there for a week and recorded one suite per day.
Oh, wow.
So I gave myself one day per suite and it was really, really tight.
Yeah.
It was really tough. On the other hand, I really didn't want to belabor it. I wanted it to come out. I just, the way it was going to come out, I wanted it to come out and I didn't want to get too bogged down.
Yeah.
So I think there's a balance there. I think I could have done easily another 6 days of recording. That would have been, I think, amazing in some ways. And I'm not sure that it actually would have gotten a very different product in the end.
How many hours were you in the studio each day for each suite?
I got there at 9 or 10 in the morning and stayed until 5 or 6.
Oh, wow. Oh, so really all day?
Oh, yeah.
And so did you play the whole suite through? Did you take it movement by movement and play each movement 3-4 times so that you had something to work with? How did you lay that out?
Yeah, I did each movement separately so that I could really get into the character of that movement and really... But I did do them basically in order. So do the prelude and do that 3-4 times. And then sometimes we did smaller chunks just to make sure that we got all of what we wanted. And really gotten the character, really gotten all of the stuff out of it, squeezed everything out.
Yeah.
And then moved on to the Alamond. So it was really like, okay, go deep into that one. And then next, go deep into the next movement.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
Well, that's really helpful. Thank you so much for that in-depth description, because recording is very intimidating for a lot of us. And I even tell my students, just record yourself every week. Just pull your phone out just to make yourself a little nervous and to really hone in on what you're doing. You can't pick everything up, obviously, from a phone microphone, but you can hear if you're playing in tune and you have good rhythm. You can tell if you have some sense of dynamic range. So, and every time we turn that on, it makes us feel nervous, like we're playing in front of someone else. So practicing that, I think, really helps with performance anxiety.
Bingo.
Is there anything else we might have missed that you'd like to offer to our audience today?
I guess just, you know, both this Bach project and the improvisation and all of that is just that sometimes we forget that we're doing this for us. We're playing our cellos for ourselves. And just to, I guess I just want to encourage everybody to find their passion project, what they're really interested in, not because it'll get them gigs or because it's going to win them an audition or whatever for the career,
yeah.
But just to have something that's really your own and that you can really get something out of that is just for yourself. Because I think that's where, for me, at least in my career, those are the highlights. And it's been, I think, one of the ways that I haven't, well, I should say this. I've seen some colleagues get really burnt out because they haven't been getting what they put into their musical life. They haven't been really getting it back. So I would just, for all our cellists out there, even if you're just starting out or if you've been in this business forever, just encourage people to find something that they're really just wanting to do for themselves and do it as much as you possibly can every day.
Yeah, so that we're feeding our souls.
That's right.
It's easy to forget that when you're trying to earn a paycheck every week. Also.
Yes.
Well, that's great. Well, it's been wonderful to catch up with you after about 2 years and hear what you're up to and all of the change. So if anybody has the opportunity, where is the best place to find your album and to find you online?
So I think maybe my website might be the best place. It's saeunn.com. And then you can find my Instagram and Facebook and how to find my CD and all of those things.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining us today on the Cello Sherpa podcast.
Thank you so much, Joel.
Thank you so much to Sayun Thorsten's daughter for joining us today and sharing her story with us. And thank you for listening to another episode of the Cello Sherpa podcast. For more information on Sayun and any of the links we spoke about today, check out our show notes by scrolling down on the episode. Be sure and catch our next episode, which is a special episode coming out in 1 week.
we talk about how to protect yourself against scammers who have been targeting professional musicians, and we give you some very important tips to help protect yourself against these sophisticated scammers.
We're here to serve you. So if you have questions or topic suggestions you would like to cover in future episodes, please use the contact page on our website, thecellosherpa.com, or tweet them at us at thecellosherpa. You will also find information about the specific services we offer on the website. Don't forget to follow us and rate us on whatever platform you get your podcasts. This helps us climb the rankings so other people can find us. Today's episode was produced, edited, and recorded by me, Joel Dallow.